Hello and welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with none other than Tom McDonald.
Hello.
A.K.A. Old McDonald. He has a farm.
I do. I have two dogs and four chickens. And
that's
they
right.
go cluck and woof woof.
With a bark bark here and a bark bark there.
That's right.
So yeah, and here we are. It's the second weekday of ordinary time. And, you know, life is beautiful in every way. So we had Pentecost, and it was our kids all came over, as well as three granddaughters came over. And
wow.
So they, yeah, it was pretty fun. I had a good time. It was a light and nice way to spend a Sunday. The plan was to have Mother's Day-ish festivities because we couldn't do them on Mother's Day. And so kids came over and paid their respects to Mom, and it was good. So anyway, we're here today with Tom McDonald. Tom is my resident knower of all arcana. And today, though, we're not going to be talking about arcana so much as I ran across a website today. Somebody pointed it out to me. The website is titled Literally Unbelievable, which already cracks me up. Literally is one of those words that people use way too much and they don't know what it means.
They literally don't know what it means.
Which is an actual real use of the word literal that was correct.
It's like, I literally died from laughing is
right.
Not a clear use, correct use.
You didn't literally die from laughing. Yeah. So anyway, somebody started this website called Literally Unbelievable, and it's devoted to just going around the web and finding the tweets and Facebook posts of extremely gullible people who take articles from The Onion or Clickhole seriously and then flip out about them. And so that's all it is. And it's screamingly funny because the Onion articles are funny already. And then you have people who are like freaking out because, you know, Monsanto has reported that a deranged tomato has broken out of its containment unit and is attempting to, you know, destroy New York or something like this. And people are freaking out, writing in capital letters and all this stuff. And I got to thinking about that. And it's just one of the things that I care about in my quixotic battle with reality is people learning how to parse what they read on the internet so they're not forever having hysterics about stupid crap. And so I thought it might be fun today to just talk a little bit about fallacies. Fallacies that
fallacy.
People fall into all the time because they don't know how to sort out. Part of it is just not being familiar with how the internet works. So, you know, you get somebody who gets their first computer. There are apparently still people out there who don't have computers and don't have internet access.
Gosh, those people are so lucky.
And but you get people, you know, who log online for the first time, and there are people who, for whom reality is frightening and overwhelming, and when they when they encounter the internet, they make themselves crazy by becoming terrified about J.K. Rowling's statement that she wrote Harry Potter books in order to involve children with witchcraft, and that she herself runs a coven in Scotland. And they read that. I read that on the internet. And so it's got to be true. And then they get all worked up about things like this. And there are people who are kind of predisposed to that sort of thing, just fears about, you know, Obama is there's a military exercise that's going to happen this summer in Texas, and Obama's going to come and take all our guns and put us in concentration camps, or you know, the scientists who are working to create killer sheep, or, you know, there's just all of that stuff that it's like, you've already got enough troubles in your life. Don't borrow trouble by being afraid about things that aren't real.
Well, that's one of the I pulled out of social media for the last month or so, and my life's much more peaceful. I'm not on Twitter or Facebook or scanning headlines or the blogosphere fiercely, so I'm much more at peace with the world when I ignore it, because but you know, and it's not just a matter of turning away, it's a matter of we become so conditioned to this bombardment of information, some of it just nonsense or useless or if not real pertinence to our current situation, right. You know, and particularly, and there's a very narrow sliver of Catholics on the internet that obsess over everything being said and done, and you know, all this inside ecclesiastical baseball. Right. Really, we don't need to know about any of this. We do just fine if we say our prayers, shut up, and go to communion.
This is something that that Bishop Robert Barron pointed out.
Did he?
Yeah, he was pointing out that we're now living in an age of, you know, 24/7 news coverage of every fine-tuned, granular thing that somebody in the Roman Curia says about whatever, you know, the sort of my iconic story for that is something that happened, gosh, now it's about a decade ago, but L'Osservatore Romano posted some editorial in which basically one of the Ents of Rome said, well, it appears the Beatles were pretty good. And it was like, I don't know, 2006 or 7 or something.
Yeah, I remember it.
It was just like, okay, thank you for that bulletin, you know. Rome, ever on the cutting edge of societal evolution, you know. But it was hilarious to me that, like, you know, you know, it's been, 35 years now or something since John Lennon died, and, you know, the Beatles broke up in 1970, and finally someone at L'Osservatore Romano delivered themselves of the opinion that the Beatles were all right.
They were all right.
And, you know, so you get things like this. So you, on the one hand, you have the world's oldest bureaucracy navigating reality and doing it with all the swift machine-like efficiency for which Italy is known. And on the other hand, you've got, you know, like American, you know, arch super reactionary traditionalists just like sitting there on the edge of their chairs waiting for every little blip that comes across the radar to panicking about what it's all going to mean and how the church is about to apostatize because of blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And it's like, get a grip, man. So, you know, the other day, there was something in the news. This happens a lot. And I, you know, I can't help but think that Francis kind of thinks it's hilarious. But, you know, Pope Francis mentioned something about taking a look at the question of...
Oh, do you want to know the...
Go for it. Yeah.
Okay. So it was an open question thing. He was taking questions and somebody asked about women deacons. So he was asked about it and he said, this is from the official story. He said, it's his understanding that the women, I'll read straight from CNA article. It's his understanding that the women described as deaconesses in the Bible were not ordained like permanent deacons, but assisted at the baptism of women by immersion of other women and the anointing of women. And then he said, however, okay, here we go. Get ready to grab your pants because they're about to be set on fire. Okay. I will ask the congregation for the doctrine of faith to tell me if there are studies on this. And then he said, I'll have a full explanation of all of this stuff on what it is, and I'll have a commission prepare a report. Okay. So you understand now what I deliberately, beyond reading the seeking out news story and reading those facts, deliberately refused to click on any link about women deacons. Right. But I saw them, and what do you think happened with that?
Golly, it's so hard to predict. I'm going to go way out on a limb and say that progressive Catholics heard this as, we will soon be ordaining women deacons, and then, who knows, priests perhaps, right after that, after, right. You know, and then we'll make smoking a doobie with the Pope, the Eighth Sacrament. I mean, anything is possible. Who even knows, you know?
Sure.
And then, and this is the thing that gets me, people who should know better then say, I read on this leftist website that the and I believe all of that because I hate this Pope and I'm afraid of him. And
commission women deacons.
And, it's yep. all going to happen. It's the end of the world, you know? And then of course there's nothing to that. And it's kind of like the Pope is going, well, it turns out that the Pope is not the compendium of all knowledge. And there are things that, you know, the Pope may not be current on. Like, what was the status of, what was a deaconess in the first century?
Right. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'll have him look into that, and we'll get a commission to see what the story is.
Here's what I remember. I'm not really sure. We'll look into it, you know. Yeah, but
it was a straight-up correct reading, by the way, but he was being, you know...
It's Mark Shea. We're here today with Tom McDonald. We're talking about rumors, fallacies, and the internet. We'll be back right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Hello, neighbor, and welcome back. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Tom McDonald. I was going to throw out the phone number, but it turns out our phones are down today.
You know why they went down? Because of all the people who were calling in?
Yeah, that's probably it. You can still text in.
You can text in? What's the text?
Just dial.
Oh, it's the same one?
Yes. Dial 1-573-4-BREAD-4, and you can text in, and you can give us what for, or you can give us 1-573-4-BREAD-4.
Stop, it hurts.
You can also tweet us at Breadbox Media. So, you know, hit us with your best shot, in the words of Pat Benatar. That's right. And in the meanwhile... wanted to return. So yeah, you get, you know, there's been a lot of freakoutery about this Pope basically ever since the second he was elected, from people who just hate him and are looking for any reason to accuse him. And there's also, this is the month of May, and that means May 13th is the anniversary of the first apparition at Fatima. And so, in addition to everything else, this is the month where people flip out about every rumor that they want to believe about some kind of conspiracy that surrounds Fatima.
Yep.
So there's the Pope John Paul did not consecrate Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary conspiracy, and then, which goes with this because Sister Lucia said, oh yes, he did. Then there's the elaborate Sister Lucia was killed by shadowy forces, probably engineered by Jews and Masons, and then replaced with a body double.
Oh, just like Paul.
Just like Paul McCartney?
Paul McCartney, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Paul died in that car accident.
That's right. And plus, you can see a picture of Sister Lucia holding the Mannlicher Carcano rifle that was used to kill President Kennedy. It's all there. It's, you can find it on the web. And who would invent something like that? Who would go to the trouble of inventing a conspiracy theory like that if it weren't true? So there you go. So that's, you know, this is what the web does for us. The web is a fountain of information, some of it true.
I was just reading Fatima conspiracy stuff this week, and it was that the third secret was really the church shall apostatize and it shall begin at the top.
Okay.
And the real argument about that interpretation, that understanding, is whether it was John the 23rd or whether it's Francis. You know, so
fan people, you know, why can't it be both John the 23rd and Pope Francis?
Yeah, plus, we are
everybody both else in between, you know. So yeah, that's the thing about the interwebs is, and by the way, no longer is seeing believing. You can go on the web and find skillfully and not so skillfully photoshopped pictures of everything.
Sure.
Including, you know, photo documentary evidence that Pope John Paul II was in fact a reptilian from another dimension. It's all there.
And you know, actually, sometimes the weirder stories are actually the more interesting. like, well, do you know who Lawrence Downey was? Does that name mean anything to you?
Not
Lawrence Downey was a former monk, kicked out for punching his superior in the face.
Okay.
Who he's Trappist. He was a Trappist. And
so not allowed to talk, so he let his fists do his talking.
That's right. So he became a tour guide at FAP and became obsessed and hijacked an Aer Lingus plane and demanded that Pope John Paul II release the third secret of Fatima.
Are you kidding?
No, I'm not making that up.
Wow.
He held the plane for like you know, half a day or so. You know, it was the sort of thing, like a few hours. I don't remember the exact length, but this was before the third secret had been released at all.
Okay.
And some people are really into this.
Well, you know what? Of course, what all this speaks to is tremendous, deep, deep insecurities and fears, as you that doesn't take a lot of profundity for me to notice that. But yeah, so what we get back to, of course, is having a fundamental sense of trust in what it is we believe. One of the things that we believe, in addition to the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, we believe in one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church, that because the Holy Spirit is the soul of the Church, therefore the Church, no thanks to us, is trustworthy. The tradition of the Church is trustworthy. That doesn't mean, of course, that Catholics don't sin. That's why we all have to go to confession, including the Pope. And real sin, not lovable rogue faults.
Right.
We're talking about real sin. And of course, we've seen living proof of that with the priest scandals and all the rest of it. And you can look anywhere in the church and you can find sinful Catholics. And for a lot of people, the failure to get the reality that the Holy Spirit is the soul of the church, and that's why the tradition is trustworthy. It's not because we're great.
Right.
For a lot of people, that can be a real shock when you discover that Catholics that you trusted, you know, when you get let down, that's the moment where your faith really has to kick in and you have to say, am I here because Jesus is trustworthy, or am I here because I really like Father O'Malley?
Right.
And if you're here because you really like Father O'Malley, well, sooner or later, Father O'Malley is going to do something that's going to let you down. Or if not him, then somebody else. And so it really does come back to having a fundamental trust in the church. But it also comes back to being able to think clearly. And so much of the problem that we face today is that people don't know how to think clearly. They fall for all kinds of fallacies. So, you know, I put together a little list of certain kinds of fallacies. You can see these, you know, popping up on the web as well. So I sort of tried to illustrate the fallacies by using them humorously in a sentence. So first people start using the slippery slope fallacy, and the next thing you know, everybody's being herded into concentration camps and gassed. Well, you can kind of see the problem with that kind of thinking, you know?
Yeah.
But you run into that all the time on the web.
The thing is, in some of these fallacies, I mean, there are, you know, some cases in which slippery slope arguments can be made, you know, like sure. If you follow the course of the sexual revolution, how it led from, you know, divorce, contraception, gay marriage, you know, all the way down, you follow a series, not so much a slippery slope, but a series of dominoes, which kind of fell one right after the other. Right.
Yeah. And that's the thing is we have to learn how to, you know, the fact that something can happen doesn't mean that something will happen. That somebody is setting themselves up with a logical domino doesn't mean necessarily that domino will get knocked over.
Right.
But it certainly means that it can be knocked over.
Yeah. And it's sloppy thinking to assume it applies everywhere. So it's not really a good, strong argument. It's usually, you usually only see slippery slopes in the rearview mirror.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, yeah. They're hard to predict in advance.
Other examples, and again, these are you can see the problem here. So, you know, another example is, you know, who makes ad hominem arguments, Tom?
I have an idea.
Ugly people. That's ugly. Who. That's right. So, an ad hominem argument an ad hominem fallacy is one in which you say that somebody is wrong because of something that has nothing to do with the argument that they're making.
Right. It means to the man in Latin. It means right. The argument is going not to the argument itself. Hominem, obviously, homo. Yeah. The argument's not going to the argument, but the argument's going to the maker of the argument.
Yeah. On the other hand, of course, we all of us navigate every day by the fact that if you meet somebody who's a shady creep, it doesn't necessarily mean that what they say is untrue. But it does tend to mean that if they're a shady creep, you're not going to immediately trust them.
Right.
And that's not unsound.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have to learn how to make those kinds of distinctions. Another example of a fallacy is, I'm not saying people who poison the well in arguments are exactly like Hitler, but let's just say there's a resemblance, if you catch my drift. Well, we could also talk about the argumentum ad Hitlerum, but
James Lilac's famous saying: "In the future, everyone will be Hitler for 15 minutes."
Exactly right. Yeah, but there are poisoning the well arguments. People do that. The sort of when did you stop beating your wife kinds of arguments, the arguments that poison the conversation before you ever have a chance to actually get to the truth of something. Those are all over the place. You can run into those on the internet all the time. It's amazing how often you run into those kinds of things.
Sure. And I mean, they descend into it very quickly. I mean, I don't know why internet arguments accelerate to the bottom so quickly. I don't know that anybody's gotten an answer about whatever levels of insecurity cause it or what. But
actually, I suspect in a certain sense, part of what it is a kind of security that the internet provides. We'll talk about that when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Tom McDonald. We're talking about fallacies, and we'll be back right after this.
Breadbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are back with Tom McDonald. I just ran across an obituary. It's apparently a real obituary. Mary Ann Noland, faced with the... This is like newsprint.
You shouldn't be laughing through obituary.
I know, but this is pretty amazing. It says, faced with the prospect of voting for either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, Mary Ann Noland of Richmond chose instead to pass into the eternal love of God. Sunday, May 15th.
I bet you
wow, some herself. People will do anything to get out of their voting obligations. But,
I know. This is the first year my son's voting, by the way.
Oh, what a crappy choice, man. Oh,
I'm going to teach him how to do write-ins.
Okay. Yeah, so I'm going to do too. Well, let's see. Here is a hugely popular fallacy. It's one of the most popular fallacies. I run into this constantly on the web. Of course, he never chooses the genetic fallacy. He was raised by Italians who superstitiously believe you should never do that. The genetic fallacy, everybody loves the genetic fallacy. The genetic fallacy basically says that something is true or false depending on who says it.
We get that all the time.
Oh yeah, all the time. If a Republican said it, it's a lie.
Right.
Or if a Democrat said it, it's a lie, depending on, you know, on and that's how most of our political discourse goes is like, right. I remember years ago I was at work, and a woman that I work with came in. She walked in and she had like a little book catalog in her hand that she'd gotten in the mail, and she said, and the books that were being advertised in it were things like the Federalist Papers and the Autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, and it was kind of like early Americana kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And she looked at me and she said, "Do you know if this publisher is conservative or liberal?" I said, "I don't know, you know." And she was like super concerned because she didn't want to buy, you know, the Autobiography of Benjamin Franklin from a conservative publisher because then somehow it would have cooties.
Right.
And it was like, just read the book, you know. Who cares who the publisher right. is, right?
No, but it has to be pure.
It has to be pure. You'll get cooties from it if it was published by a conservative or something. It was like, okay, whatever. I just was interested in the books. If you want to get the Federalist Papers, then buy the Federalist Papers.
Right.
But,
you know, in with a genetic fallacy, we usually see a lot of that in religious debate because, well, of course you'd believe that. You're a Christian, you know.
Right. Like, oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, we actually thought about this before we started believing it, but okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's true. Well, it poisons so much of our discourse. We're so concerned about getting cooties from somebody. And this is one of the things that Thomas Aquinas was blissfully free from. He didn't care. But he understood that truth was truth. And so here's something useful that this Muslim commentator said. So he made use of it. And he didn't worry about if he was going to get Muslim cooties
right.
from quoting Avicenna or if he was going to get pagan cooties from quoting Aristotle.
Right.
His only question was, is this true? Well, then, okay. You know? And that's something we could really, really benefit from returning to.
But we won't.
We won't. Related to the genetic fallacy is the tuquoque argument. The tuquoque, well, is best summed up when you say, some people say I use the tuquoque argument, but that's because they use the tuquoque argument. The tuquoque basically just means, oh, yeah. I know you are, but what am I?
Right. You and too. That's what it means, literally.
Yes. And it's dumb. It's a dumb way to argue. It doesn't matter. You know, if somebody is a hypocrite, great. But that doesn't mean that when they point out a fault, that they're wrong. It just means that they may be guilty of that wrong as well. But nonetheless, they could still be right when they point out some kind of error or fault.
Right.
Here's another favorite one. Have you always asked load questions like a communist child abuser, or did you just begin recently? The loaded question. That, again, is, you know, that's the when did you stop beating your wife kind of question. There's no way you can answer a loaded question without looking bad, because the question is not really framed to get at the truth. The question is really framed to just poison the audience against the person that you're questioning.
Right. You know, which is useful. I mean, let's not deny that some of these arguments are perfectly effective.
Well, they're effective at
shutting down an argument.
At shutting down an argument, they're not effective at getting at truth.
No.
So they're rhetorical devices, but they're not really designed for getting at truth. And that's the thing, is as listeners and as consumers of argument, which is part of what you're doing on the internet, the thing is to spot those kinds of clever lawyer tricks. Right. So you're not getting yourself manipulated. Another one that's very popular, which I will again illustrate with a proposition. Just after I started illustrating fallacies, such as post hoc ergo propter hoc, the sun came out. Obviously, this proves that my illustrations have power to alter the weather. Again, silly, but people make use of that fallacy a lot. You know, after so-and-so was elected, the economy of, you know, after this American politician was elected, the economy of Poland went into the toilet. Okay.
Well, it's the classic correlation equals causation. You know, that's
right.
What
yeah.
it is, you know, and while there may be some suggestion of correlation in it, which is why correlation is there. It's not proof of causation, you know.
Right, yeah.
Correlation is correlation. It's not, you know, proof. And, you know, post hoc
yes, exactly right.
is basically, you know, with this, therefore that, or because yep. of that is basically what it is in Latin, or after this, therefore that,
yeah.
you know. But we see it constantly. Remember, you know, for many, many, many years, a couple of decades, actually, I wrote, you know, about computer and video games. Uh-huh. And one of the things was always, well, obviously, you know, we're seeing all of these school shootings, so video games must be causing them. And I said, well, that's interesting, but let's look at, these are aberrant activities, these school shootings. They're hardly common. We see them and read a lot about them, but they're not normative. So let's look at the actual data and what the data, which would be crime data. Is there a rise in juvenile crime? And in fact, there's an exact reversal of correlation and causation between them, so that as video game usage rises among youth, violence drops.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the periods, the violent crime statistics dropped over the same period as the growth of the video gaming industry. It seems counterintuitive, but you know, everybody could easily say, you know, obviously this is causing these school shootings.
Right.
You know, so let's look at what else might be in actual reasons. A lot of times these correlation proves causation things are a way to avoid getting to real answers.
Right.
And to just ride somebody's hobby horse.
Yeah. Yeah. And there have been, you know, this has caused fatalities in the past. So for example, during the period of the Black Death, Jews tended to fare better during plague times than Gentiles did. Why? Well, because Jews observed purity laws.
Sure.
And so they were cleaner than Gentiles were.
Well, one of the main things actually that's emerged from analysis of some of this is that it was, traditionally part of that was airing linen once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And they believe that was what killed the fleas.
Okay.
So that they tend to be protected from the plague.
So there was a correlation, but what often happened during plague times was Gentiles would assume that correlation meant causation. And so Jews are surviving and we're not. They're causing the plague. why are they surviving and we're not? Because they're killing us. And so then we get a pogrom come out of that. And correlation and causation things have long been a bugbear. I remember somebody, Michael Flynn, who I mentioned on the show in the past, the author of Eiffelheim, he's a statistician. And so he put up a bunch of correlation statistics that were just hilarious. So it was like, popularity of Nicolas Cage films and nun death rates. And it was
right. There's actually there's a whole website dedicated to that. Of ridiculous matching graphs, you know, like shark attacks and you know, paralleling the lifetime of Snooki or something like that.
Yeah, and so, you know, somebody put up was like, it was a photograph of a Swiss mountain range or something, and the peaks exactly correlated to, like, you know, gun violence rates in Chicago or something. It was like, why are these mountains killing Chicagoans? Post hoc, ergo propter hoc, correlation does not presume causation. So we'll continue when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we'll be back with Tom McDonald right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
There was something about that. Welcome back. We are here today with Tom McDonald. We're talking about fallacies and learning to think straight. Fallacies always tend to have a certain sort of plausibility to them. And so, of course, one way to kind of illustrate them is to show what's actually being said. So the most popular moral heresy in the world is consequentialism.
Oh, yeah.
Consequentialism is the belief that the ends justify the means. And so to illustrate the consequentialist fallacy, I wrote, I'm going to educate people on the consequentialist fallacy and moral reasoning if I have to torture and murder every innocent man, woman, and child in Seattle to do it.
It's popular because it seems logical.
It does.
You know, it's funny. You know, you see things like, well, you know, you have to think of these worst case scenarios. Would you kill one person to save 1,000? It's like, well, I don't know. It's an interesting question if you're playing intellectual games, but, you know, do you really want to be making those decisions and do those actually happen in real life?
Yeah.
You know, and the fact is, yes, it would be evil. You know, killing one person to save 1,000 is still evil.
There's a biblical incident about that, you know, that a lot of people...
Tell us, Caiaphas, what is that biblical incident?
Yes, it is better that one man die than for the whole nation to perish was exactly what Caiaphas said about engineering the death of Jesus. That was exactly the reasoning that he used. And it's still something that you hear people, of course, say today. I wouldn't call it evil exactly. I would call it tough choices. Right. I would call it, you know, being willing to get my hands dirty, which is all BS for saying I want to do something evil, something that is wrong.
you know, when we all went down, you know, a society, meaning, went down that road with the war on terror and the ticking time bomb scenario suddenly became very popular, you know. Well, if you
love that.
And yeah. I'm saying, and they're always asking the wrong questions when they're playing this, this logical game, which is, did that ever actually happen? Has there been a ticking time bomb that could be stopped by torturing somebody? Other than 24.
Always left out exactly is that when we think of ticking time bomb scenarios, what we're always thinking of are shows like 24 or some suspense movie that we've seen. And of course, the trick to those shows is you already know that the bad guy in the movie is the bad guy, and you know what he knows because you saw him plant the bomb. Right. So you know he's guilty.
Sure.
Well, the thing is that with torture to get information, the reason you're doing the torture is to find out if the person you're torturing is worth being tortured. Right. That's the beginning of it. But the other problem, of course, is that you get these ticking time bombs. Whenever you get scenarios like this, what people always forget is that they're looking at a piece of artifice, a fake scenario. Well, suppose
right.
X, Y, and Z obtain.
Right.
Well, okay, but you just created that scenario out of thin air so that you could force your audience to come to the conclusion that you've already decided you want them to come to. And you're going to always play that game. Suppose there's, you know, a 13-year-old girl who's been raped multiple times by her father and has a tubal pregnancy. Surely you cannot say that, you know, abortion is wrong. Given a situation like this. And so it's always possible to construct, you know, an emotionally manipulative scenario. People will die if you don't torture this guy.
People think all arguments should be immune to those extravagant scenarios or their false arguments. And the fascinating thing about this in the torture debate with consequentialism was that consequentialism is functionally the root of modernism and utilitarianism. It is the idea that, you know, if you look at Peter Singer, the so-called ethicist, who is basically maximism, the goal of society should be, you know, maximization of pleasure for the most number of people at the highest degree, so that a baby is no more a moral agent than a puppy. Right. You know, or we look at Jeremy Bentham and these other utilitarians, and what you get is this utilitarianism. And I don't see that it's all that far from consequentialism, you know, because these arguments basically are based on, well, we've got to maximize the opportunity for pleasure for the most amount, or the opportunity of happiness, the aggregate happiness, as I think utilitarianists say, the happiness of everybody compared to that of a particular person, or the success of society compared to the success of the, where in fact the success and happiness and pleasure of society is dependent on the success and happiness and pleasure of numerous individuals.
Right. You know, and especially
it's not abstract. It's not a thing. It doesn't exist in and of itself aside from individual human beings.
And in the Christian tradition, it's especially dependent on the happiness of the least of these.
Right.
The people who are at the bottom of the heap, this is again something that Bishop Robert Barron has pointed out, that when God enters history, he enters history as cultural detritus. He is, you know, the lowest of the low. The reason that Jesus is crucified is because that's the kind of fate that's reserved for scum.
Right.
People who don't matter, you know. And so he sides with those who do not matter.
Well, and that's why modernism turned on Christianity so much. And based on those, you know, before we got to these Christianity is icky arguments, mm-hmm. we got to the Christianity isn't useful arguments because it's inverted. Because, and, you know, this is pure, you know, we go back, we can't even blame this one on Nietzsche. We can go back to the French Revolution and see these kind of concerns starting to come out with the so-called Enlightenment. You know, this... we're already seeing this kind of in John Stuart Mill and other philosophers to some degree, where it's this idea that, you know, no, those inverted systems, that's the wrong way around. You know, yeah. We have to have utility, usefulness, like I said, aggregate happiness, those kind of things, yeah. You know, have to be maximized, rather than saying, as Christ obviously and correctly pointed out, is they're maximized when we concentrate on the least and right. The lowest.
Yeah. Well, let's see. If you object to emotionalist fallacies and arguments, Tom, I'm going to set fire to myself and die, and then you'll see how wrong you are. People love that, though. People love emotionalist arguments. It's a huge crowd pleaser, and you can really shut down arguments with emotionalist arguments.
Well, in the internet, again, I know we keep picking on it, but it's useful, so we might as well kick it around a little more. Is very susceptible to this because apparently everyone on the internet is a Victorian maiden ready to hit the fainting couch when something comes up. You know.
Yes.
And this emoting is very strange. These people wouldn't do this in person. And I've met them in person. They wouldn't act like this. So it's that anonymity, that once remove of communication that allows this uber emotionalism to come through.
That's one of the things I was going to point out. Thank you for reminding me. You were mentioning before the insecurity of people on the internet. But also, oddly, there's a certain kind of security that the internet provides. It's the windshield phenomenon, the sense that there's a pane of glass between you and the person that you're talking to. And so people say things to one another, and I fall prey to this. People say things to one another on the internet that they would never say face to face, because there's a sense of safety. That guy's, I'm never going to meet that guy.
You know? Well, and he's disconnected. He's not human. It's the other one is right. That there's just like little characters on a screen, and you know, it's not that much different than Angry Birds or playing Doom or something. It all comes through the same screen. So it all has the same emotional vector, and we forget that there's humans on the other side of one and mindless pixels on the other side of the other.
Oh, well, let's see. People who practice guilt by association should all be rounded up and shot, along with all their family and friends. Well, you know, we saw that with Trump last winter. He was saying, we not only have to kill terrorists, we need to kill their families, too. Got to kill their wives and children. I mean, this is something that, this is like pre-Socratic paganism, you know? kind of thing, you know? And
it's
and
even, yet, I mean, the pre-Socratics were actually a school, so I would call it pre-pre-Socratic, you know?
But I mean,
none of the pre-Socratics would have suggested that.
Bronze Age barbarism, you know? It's the idea that you go into Canaan, you kill everybody, man, woman, and child, because they're Canaanites. What else do you need to know about them, you know? So anyway, let's see.
That's a fraught analogy, by the way.
I find it impossible to believe that anybody would ever use an argument from personal incredulity as proof of anything. That's a little joke there. The argument of personal incredulity, argument from personal incredulity is, I find it difficult to believe X, Y, or Z, so it can't be true.
Right.
Well, who cares what you believe, right?
I mean, that's the heart of skepticism, too. It's
They
usually just repeat what you've said back to you.
All right. Well, thank you. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I was your host, Mark Shea. We've been talking with Tom McDonald. Our producer was Ethan Bolin, and we will be back tomorrow with Rod Bennett. Until then, have a lovely evening. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.